Oh, that's right. We're here this afternoon, and it is my great honor to have Lloyd Andrew with us here today. He's a former World War II veteran, and he has lived here in Greenwood for several years, I guess, and we're going to talk about his past and everything. He joined, he turned 18 in November and joined the Army in January, I guess that was January 1942, is that right, Lloyd?
Right.
That's right. So he is here today. I'm excited to talk to him. And how are you doing today, Lloyd Andrew?
Doing fine.
Doing fine.
I'm almost 90, so living that long is a pleasure in itself.
I got to say, I would look at that two ways. It's good, and then when you see what's going on today, sometimes you got to wonder, Lloyd.
Well, I better not get off on that.
Okay. I know a lot of people that just turn it off anymore. It's pretty bad out there.
Yeah.
But it is really a pleasure, and I want to thank you for your service to our country. Thank you so much.
You're welcome.
And we appreciate you being here today. But now, what branch of the service were you in?
In the Army Air Corps.
The Army Air Corps.
Right.
And that became the, was the, that before?
That's before the Air Force.
Force.
The Air Force wasn't formed until after World War II.
And I guess, did you just, you wanted to enlist, or was it the draft, or?
Well, they didn't even have a draft.
They didn't?
This was beforehand. I had been to a state fair in Fort Smith, Arkansas, and they had an Army recruiter there. And got to talking with him, along with a guy I was in high school with. And they talked about having this flying sergeant program. And this one, instead of getting $21 a month like you did as a private, you got a lot more. So we said, okay, we'll do that. Well, I graduated in January, had the teachers give me the finals along with my friend. We did this step by step. Took the final grades up to the principal. The principal gave me a diploma. My dad was waiting out in front of the high school, drove to Little Rock, and we signed up in January.
Wow.
But, of course, that's just immediately after Pearl Harbor.
Exactly. So, and what happened then?
Well, they had such a rush of people joining, because the war was on at that point, that they sent me home for a couple of months, and then eventually went to Little Rock, rode a steam-driven train from Little Rock to California, Santa Ana, California, and started training. And the base was new. The streets were not paved. The mud was a foot deep. We had no uniforms. We wore fatigues, jumpsuits, I guess you call them.
Right.
And we drilled with brooms and with sticks, because they didn't have any rifles.
And, for real?
Yeah, for real.
Wow.
And I guess I was there several months, and then went to primary training in Santa Maria, California, and started flying.
You know, we just weren't prepared to go to war, were we?
That's right. But you think about the tremendous effort and what they accomplished in such short time. It was really phenomenal. I doubt that this country could do that well today. In the first place, they've lost their steel mills, and they've lost their shipyards and all that stuff. So I don't think they'd have the capacity to do it like they did then.
Well, how did they? Okay, so you trained with brooms and sticks and this type of thing. And then how did you get to the next step then?
Well,
sticks didn't shoot very well, did they?
No. No. This was pre-flight training in Santa Ana, and then we were already enrolled in the flight program. And so they sent everyone up to the a pilot school all over the country. And I went up to Santa Maria, California, learned to fly in a PT-13 Stearman, an open cockpit
biwing. Yes, biwing, right.
Mm-hmm. It was great. Airplane. It was a fun airplane to fly, because you could do loops and rolls and all that sort of thing.
Did you get to do any of that? Any of the loops and all that kind of stuff?
Oh, yeah, sure, all the time. Oh, yeah. Okay. After you soloed, you could do whatever you wanted.
Wow, okay.
Because you were just putting in time after that. You did shoot landings, you know, so you got proficiency in takeoff and landings.
Sure.
And then from there, I went to basic training. That's with a closed cockpit plane, steel single engine, in Lemoore, California, and Tucson, Arizona. Finished that training and went to Stockton, California for advanced training. That was twin engine training, and we flew all kinds of twin engine airplanes there. And then in 43, got commissioned as a second lieutenant with pilot's wings and so forth. After that, they sent me up to Sacramento, California, flying B-25s. And that was a lot of fun, too, because they were twin engines.
What was the mood, though, there? What was the mood? Were people thinking, oh, we're going to have to be going, or what was the mood? What was the mood of the country?
Oh, I think everyone was almost universally united to do what it took to win the war. I mean, I'm sure there were plenty of slackers and so forth, because, you know, as they had to have a draft and people did get drafted and so forth. But for the most part, I didn't see anything but people were out to win the war.
And it was from women, then women ended up working in the factories and everything when you guys were gone, right?
Yeah, sure.
So how did you get from doing that? Weren't you one of the first pilots to fly the triple engine?
The four-engine?
Four-engine, right.
No. There were hundreds, I guess thousands, that flew four engines. After training in B-25s, went down to Hobbs, New Mexico, and flew B-17 down there. And this is about the time they really started building up the 8th Air Force. And they then transferred me up to Boise, Idaho, and that's where we got the crew.
Mm-hmm.
10-man crew.
Now that was unique, wasn't it, that they'd go with a 10-man crew?
Well, all the B-24s had 10-man crews.
Right.
Yeah. Pilot, co-pilot, navigator, bombardier, top turret, two waist gunners, excuse me, a ball turret gunner and a tail gunner.
That was a pretty big crew, wasn't it?
Yeah.
And to be the captain there of it was, or the pilot, that was pretty a lot of going on, wasn't it?
Yeah, well, I was the youngest one on the crew. We had an old man on the crew.
He
was
an old
ball
man.
Turret gunner, 32 he was. And since I was so young compared to the rest of them, when we first formed, we got up in the air, and I got each one of them to get up and sit in the pilot seat and try to fly the plane. Because, you know, they thought all you got to do is just sit there like driving a truck. There was a little more to it than that.
Well, that was a good idea.
Yeah,
yeah, it worked. Yeah, it made everybody respect the fact that you were the pilot.
Yeah.
Hey, I tell you what, we are here with Lloyd Andrew. We're going to have a fascinating hour here. So I certainly hope you're going to stay tuned right with us at WCRS. Let's hear a quick word from our sponsors. We'll be back. Hey, if you've got a question or something you'd like to input to this conversation, give us a call, 229-7984. That's 229-7984. We'll be right back.
Gold. Gold, more precious than any other time in history. Do you have gold? Do you need cash? Then bring it to SFG. That's Sharp Facets Gallery, 1220 Bypass 72, Greenwood. Telephone 229-6613. Don't forget, we buy diamonds too. Paying the highest prices for your gold and diamonds at Sharp Facets Gallery.
Oh, that's right. We're right back here, Sharp Facets Gallery. I'm right here on WCRS. I am here with Lloyd Andrew. He certainly had some fabulous experiences during World War II, and he's sharing some of them. Probably some of the ones you don't always get to hear, which is what I try to concentrate on, some of the different stuff. And Lloyd, you know, one of the questions I was just asking you off the air, did you have any fun when you were going through all this training and everything? Did you have any fun?
Sure. We did. Being young and male, we chased the girls all over the country, every place we were.
But they kept moving you around.
Yes, indeed.
They didn't let you stay anywhere very long, did they?
No. Well, we were down in Tonopah, Nevada, and the only way we could see any girls, because it was an abandoned silver mine town.
Oh,
the only way we could see any girls is to go to Reno. So we got the local guy that ran the bus station. He had a stretch limousine, and we'd sign him up, and he wanted to get out of Tonopah and go to Reno, too. So we got a good deal, and then we could chase the girls all over Reno and then come back to Tonopah. Have at it.
Oh, for the good old days, Lord.
Right.
Yeah,
no, I couldn't do it again.
That's right. But you were telling me that one of your favorite parts was when you made that long-distance trip across, flying over the ocean. Tell us a little bit about how you got to this trip. I mean, this sounds fascinating.
Well, this was in January, so most of the time you would fly your new airplane over the northern route to Iceland and that way. But in the winter, it was very difficult weather-wise, so we went the southern route. And that's when we went to Brazil and then to Africa and then up to England. And
when you flew down there, though, how did you find the landmarks and everything? How did you know
where
you
were? We had a navigator.
You had a navigator?
Yeah. And we never got lost. I guess we were lucky in that sense. But he did a good job. The only thing, just before we got to Dakar, Africa, we were still over the ocean, and he was a little concerned about whether we were on target to make it to Dakar. And he called up and asked if he had permission to get a radio fix, so I gave it to him, because if he was worried, I'd better be worried.
Exactly.
So he got that fix, and he was right on target.
Okay.
We stayed there several days because just before we landed, the guys smelled a fuel leak, and we had a leaking gas tank, and you can't fly with a leaking gas tank.
Well, how did you go from Brazil all the way to Dakar? And you told me you left like at 8 o'clock at night, didn't you?
Yeah, and you arrive in the morning 12 hours later.
12 hours, and the plane was able to carry that amount of fuel? Now you got me scared because you had a fuel leak.
Oh. Right. No, that was stretching a bit, but it had plenty of fuel.
Plenty of fuel.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Wow. So how was it to fly down to all these places? I bet it was fascinating to see from overhead and see the vegetation and all the stuff.
Oh, yeah, especially in at the mouth of the Amazon. That was a lot of interesting stuff because it was all jungle. There wasn't much in Fortaleza in Brazil. In Dakar, it was a terribly poor town. The natives lived in huts. All of them had a black kettle where they cooked their food and so forth, and there was absolutely nothing to do there. They were desperate for everything. You had to have an armed guard out at almost on every airplane because they would steal the canvas covers you put over the engine and anything else they could get because they were destitute.
Wow. So you stayed there for how long?
Well, we stayed there 4 days until they flew in a replacement gas tank. And from there, we went to Marrakech in Morocco. But that was a very frightening experience because we had to go over the Sahara Desert. And a sandstorm started up. And that's the darndest thing I ever saw. It was really scary. The sand would bubble up. Have you ever cooked cream of wheat?
Yep.
And watch how it bubbles? Well, that's the way that darn sand looked like.
Up above, where you were flying?
Well, it was below when we started, and then it just built up and built up. And finally, it built up. We got up to 11,000 feet, and we were still in terrible turbulence. I had to ask the co-pilot to grab a hold of this thing and help me hold it because we were just pitched around something fierce. It was really frightening. In fact, one of the guys in our group landed there and landed in the Sahara Desert. We actually saw the plane down there from where we were, and he and the crew were interned for the rest of the war. But it was really something because the planes were not built to get that kind of agitation, and it just felt like it was all going to shake apart. But we finally got up in the northern end of the Sahara Desert and went over the mountains and landed in Marrakech. So, and from there we spent, I think, 2 nights in Marrakech in an abandoned olive orchard.
In an abandoned orchard?
They put these tents up that we stayed in, but the olives were still there. They hadn't been harvested, and it smelled terrible.
Wow, that is really interesting stuff. Interesting stuff. Now, when you flew like a 12-hour flight, did you pilot the whole time?
Oh, yeah, but we had a automatic pilot.
Okay.
So you could put it, when you're going on an ocean flight like that, just put an automatic pilot. But you also have a co-pilot.
Sure.
So our automatic pilot was absolutely no good.
Because?
Well, we were doing...
Here's another story, folks.
Yep. We were doing a fuel consumption mission flying out of Marchfield in California. And we would go up and down the San Joaquin Valley because we're just putting time in to see what the consumption was. And I had it on automatic pilot, and this system had a knob where you could turn it, and it would hydraulically control the plane and turn it to where you wanted to go. Well, I turned the thing, and immediately it went nose down. The airplane completely immediately nosed down. The poor engineer flew up in the top turret and cut his head open, and it was really scary. But the guys in the back end, they flew up to the top of the plane, and afterward they said, well, we knew that Slingshock, the co-pilot, wanted to be a fighter pilot. We thought he must have taken it over and decided to roll it or something. But anyway, after that, I never used that turn control again. We did use the automatic pilot.
Wow. Yeah.
But we had to go through one weather front going across the Atlantic, and they warned you that you're liable to get into a lot of turbulence. But we were extremely fortunate. Flew into the cloud, flew on instruments, of course, and we were in there maybe 4 or 5 minutes and broke out, and it was completely clear, and it was sunny all the way to Africa.
Those have to be some marvelous experiences as you look back. Do you ever think, how did I live through all these things that I went through?
Well, never think about it. Just glad it's behind you.
I know that I've done some things that I look back on and say, I can't believe you did that,
yep.
Ann. You know, you've got a picture where you were flying. Now, where was this? This is up in the clouds here. Where was that?
That was taken on a mission.
On a mission?
Yeah.
Yeah.
They had photographers with every group. They
really
took lots of pictures. Oh, yeah. They needed them more for bomb damage than anything else. But they would take pictures of airplanes like that. I've got a number of them like that.
Wow. That's pretty cool.
I brought that because Dee said she didn't know what a B-24 was.
Okay. So. so now we know. That's right. And you told her that those are very difficult to fly.
Well, more so than a B-17. They were more sensitive to controls. They had what you call a high lift wing, whereas a B-17 had a great big wing, and it would just float like a bird, but these things wouldn't. They had to be flown.
They had to be flown. And, of course, I guess, did you have a lot more, were you able to carry a lot more bombs and ammunition on it?
Theoretically, yes.
Okay.
But the reason was a B-24 had a bigger bomb bay. You could put big bombs in it, mm-hmm. but its fuel consumption was not as good, so you couldn't go very far if you were up at high altitude. So the B-24 was far superior in the South Pacific, where you flew low over the ocean all the time. But we were flying above 20,000 feet, and the B-17s had much better range than we did.
So you had to be kind of worried about how long you planned to stay in the air.
Yeah, well, one of the nice things about that was that many days the 8th Air Force mission would include a target in Berlin and often in a town called Brunswick. It was Big B and Little B. And we were always thrilled when we got Little B and the B-17s had to go to Big B. 'Cause That's where you really caught it.
Yeah, exactly. I tell you what, I'm here with Lloyd Andrew. We are talking about World War II. When we come back, we're going to talk some more about some of what happened to him and some interesting stories. I hope you'll stay right with us. Now it's time for South Carolina News. We'll be back.
McDonald's presents Confessions of an Ex-Hipster.
I loved cappuccinos, so I put on an itchy turtleneck and grew a goatee. But before I knew it, I was into French films, indie rock, and not bathing. Luckily, I got help from McDonald's McCafe cappuccinos. Now I'm watching football, wearing khakis, even high-fiving again. Thank you, McDonald's.
New McCafe mochas, lattes, and cappuccinos from McDonald's. With fresh ground espresso and real steamed milk, it's all the coffee, hold the attitude. At participating McDonald's.
Visit your local McDonald's in Greenwood and Abbeville today.
All right, we're back here, Sharp Facets Gallery, my studio in the back of Sharp Facets Gallery. I am talking with Lloyd Andrew today, and he was in World War II, and we've been talking about some of the fascinating parts of his life. But Lloyd, I just need to ask you, you know, I've never been in the military, and I can't imagine to be in a war situation where, you know, you could die. I mean, you know, you get in the car and you drive out there on the road, you know you could die, but it's not the same as having it staring you in the face. And I know there is a story about how you were supposed to be in a mission, but you had a bad cold and you didn't go. Can you tell us about that one?
Well, I got a severe cold and had to go into the hospital. And the operations officer took the crew that I had trained with and flew over to England. On their first mission to Berlin, their first mission period. Mm-hmm. And they got shot up and eventually got shot down. The co-pilot and the bombardier and some of the rest of the crew bailed out, and they bailed out just before the plane hit the ground. The navigator, top turret gunner, and the radio would not bail out soon enough. The navigator finally did bail out, but it was so late, and the plane apparently was so close to the ground that he was caught under the wing. The reason I know that is I talked to the co-pilot after the war, but also the bombardier wrote about this mission, and he said the co-pilot was trying to get everyone to get out, bail out, and the navigator just for some reason was reluctant. When he finally did get out, he got caught under the wing. And he was under the wing when the plane crashed, and the co-pilot was permitted by the Germans who captured him to go do a Catholic service, because the navigator and the co-pilot were both Catholic, and that's how they knew what had happened to him.
Wow.
And the pilot, of course, was killed, and I guess...
Because the pilot tried to get the plane going.
He was trying to keep it going and so forth, and it was futile.
Yeah. That has to have been... And then they became... prisoners of war,
yes. Yeah, those that weren't killed were prisoners of war all through the war until the Russians liberated them.
You know, I know it's part of life, but how did you feel? Because that was going to be your mission.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah.
Well, since it was going to be the first mission, I guess I didn't have any particular feelings about it, and I was feeling bad enough with that cold, but... You know, you just get kind of used to the idea that you ask about you getting killed and that sort of thing. Well, indeed, you can. But you also can see an end in sight. Because in that war, we went to win the war. We didn't go over there to police somebody else's war. And as long as you had that good end in sight, it was an incentive. But as I told you earlier, only half of the crew that we, or half of the group that we flew over to England with, ended up finishing the tour. All the rest were shot down. So it was
tremendous.
It was a lot of losses. Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Did you get kind of desensitized to it because there was so much loss?
Well, it's a job.
It's a job.
You were trained to do it. Good training.
Right.
And you were expected to do it. Now some of them didn't. Knew several pilots who absolutely could not fly. They were emotionally unstable in having to fly. They couldn't stand it, and so they would ground them. I had a good friend that happened to him. there were other people. I had a gunner, a waste gunner. He could do his job. He did fine, but he would kind of mope around all the time on when we were on the ground. And he would sit there with his boots, and he'd take the laces out one by one, and then he'd put the laces back in, and he'd wrap them up. And he could sit there for an hour or two doing nothing but lacing and unlacing his boots. I mean, he was just emotionally distraught, but he did his job.
But he did his job.
Yeah.
It's amazing. It's amazing, and particularly when you look back, and after the war, it seemed like everybody just came back to go to work in our country.
That's right.
It wasn't any, I can't do this, I can't do that.
Or help me or anything. Well, we got help on the GI Bill.
Sure.
And it was a great effort.
It was. Mm-hmm. It was. When you were in so when did you actually fly your first mission then? Because you had the cold that first time.
About two or three weeks after they got shot down. Actually, I was fortunate because there was another pilot who flew a couple of missions, and when he got up to altitude, he passed out, and he passed out twice.
Oh my God.
And his co-pilot had to take over. And so, excuse me, they grounded him, sent him back to the States. So here I was without a crew, and here was a crew without a pilot, and then I finished up the tour with that bunch. So it worked out good.
And were they a good crew?
Oh, yeah, they were fine. Yeah.
You know, I like the story you told about when everybody thought it was the easy job being the pilot.
Yeah.
Yeah, and you just said, well, here, go ahead and fly this plane, right?
That's what I did, yeah. I was the youngest one. I guess I was 19. The oldest man was 32. He was an old man. And when we first formed the crew, I got each one of them to get up in the pilot seat and try to fly it and so forth.
I love it. I love it. Now, let's see. One time you were flying over Bordeaux, France?
Yeah.
Yeah? What happened on that one?
Well, that was kind of an interesting thing in that we went down to Bordeaux to bomb an airfield. It was occupied by the Germans, of course. And after each mission, an intelligence officer would look over the various photos that were taken. And he showed this one photo, and he said, any of you have any idea how this could happen? The photo showed an airplane sitting on the ramp, and a bomb had exploded right in the wing of it, and it was a comparatively small bomb. Well, that day, we were using incendiary bombs, and these were maybe a foot long and 4 inches in diameter, and they would wrap them all up and assemble them on a wooden crate-like thing, and then they'd strap them in the bomb bay and drop them, and when they fell out of the bomb bay, they would scatter, so it was easy to get a lot of airplanes from one bomb. Well, the waste gunner looked at that thing with this that the photo guy showed us. He says, oh, yeah. He says, I looked, and one of those darn bombs was loose on this wooden rack it was on. He says, I just pulled it off the rack. And he says, I looked down on the ground out the waste thing. And he says, I just threw it out. And he hit that darn plane.
Now, that's pretty good.
Yeah, it
that
was.
That is pretty good.
Yeah.
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 So
it was a lucky hit, of course.
Lucky hit, I guess so. I guess so. All right. Well, we are here with Lloyd Andrew. We are going to hear a quick word from our sponsors. When we come back, we're going to talk about some more about the war, and who knows what else we'll talk about. You got to stay here, right here on WCRS. We'll be right back.
Gold dust at my feet on the sunny side of.
This year will be a simpler year. One fine gift to last a lifetime. From Mother Earth with love, a diamond to light the way and create the energy to keep your love alive. Only at Sharp Facets Gallery, 1220 Bypass 72, Greenwood, 229-6276. Oh, that's right. We're right back here, Sharp Facets Gallery. I'm having a fascinating afternoon. I hope you're enjoying the show. Lloyd Andrew is with us. He was in the Air Corps, and he was a World War II pilot. We wanted to talk about that. You know, there are so many stories that you could share with us, but one of the other stories we wanted to share with everybody was on one flight from Berlin, your plane was hit by a German 109 fighter. Tell us about that one.
Okay. You know, the Germans, it's never a single 109. They fly at you head-on, head-to-head. They look like a bunch of blackbirds flying in formation. But, of course, we were in formation. Each group would have 12 planes and flying as tight together as you can. And the 109s had machine guns and 20-millimeter cannons. And I was flying on the wing of the lead ship, the left wing, and the one of the 109s shot a lot of the bullets, and one of the 20-millimeter cannons blew out the number two engine, put a hole about that big and thing. So I had to feather that engine. But it also, one of the 20-millimeters went in the nose, and the navigator and the bombardier who was in the nose turret were in there. It knocked the navigator out and started a small fire. So on the intercom, I told the top turret gunner, who is the engineer, to go down and put the fire out, get the bombardier out of the nose turret, and see what he could do about the navigator. Well, he did. He had a fire extinguisher and put that out. Navigator came to. He was okay. He got the bombardier out. By this time, we had fallen back from flying on the wing of the lead plane, and I had to pull up underneath in the element behind him on three engines. The oxygen system throughout the plane, I had an oxygen regulator by my left knee, and one of the bullets went right through that oxygen regulator and shut the darn system off.
Oh my
so
God.
At 20,000 feet, I needed some oxygen. So I hollered at the co-pilot to get a walk-around bottle. They were about maybe 6 inches in diameter. Well, he was so excited and nervous, he kept trying to hook that thing up, and he was making a mess of it. So I hollered for the engineer to do it. He got the walk-around bottle fixed and then got on oxygen. It was okay. We flew maybe 20, 30 minutes after that, still at high altitude and in formation. And then the fighters were gone and we let down, because I knew that on three engines we were going to be pressing it on fuel, because mm-hmm. You use more fuel with three engines than you do with four. And the I told the engineer to switch the number three engine on the number two tank. He says, you can't do that. I says, yes, you can. He said, no, you can't do that. He says, it's not connected. I said, yes, it is. I said, I'll tell you what, you try it. And so he tried it, and it worked. Well, that was fine as far as it went. But then I told the co-pilot, now look, when that number three engine runs out of that number two tank gas, you'd be ready to switch it immediately over to number three. Okay, they did that. But when they switched the thing over, the engine number three started up and the prop ran away. I don't know whether you know what that means, but it rotates at, yeah, at tremendous speeds, and it will fly off if you don't stop it. So I told the co-pilot, control that pitch. You can change the pitch on the blade. He says, I can't control it. I can't do it. So I reached up and hit the feathering button. I don't know whether you know what that is.
I don't.
But it turns the blades directly into the wind instead of flat against the wind. And fortunately, that stopped it. But we were very fortunate then. By that time, we were down maybe 6,000 feet. And I knew we were going to be pressed on gas. So I said, okay, let's get rid of all the weight we can. So pulled all of the 50 caliber machine guns and throw those out the waist. We took all of our flak jackets and stuff and threw those out and everything else we could to lighten the plane up.
Wow.
And we got back And we got just did make it back, because when we taxied back into the parking spot in the base, and another engine quit, ran out of gas, so we just barely made it.
Unbelievable. Now, how did you figure out to be able to do those things? Did you have the training for that, or
yes? Yes, that's why I was telling you earlier. I think that the Army did an excellent job of training people, because you didn't have time in circumstances like that to think about what you're going to do.
Exactly.
You respond. You do it. And like the business about the gas and knowing how those pipe things were done, the crew chief probably, if he'd had time to think about that enough, he would have known that it could be done. But I don't know why. I just knew that. We had trained on all of the intricate workings of the B-24 and knew that it could be done.
Phenomenal. What did you say that night when you got off the plane?
Thank God.
Exactly.
Yeah.
Exactly. And everybody was okay?
Oh, yeah. Yeah. Yeah, we made it. Everyone was fine.
And did you lose any planes on that mission? Any other planes? I mean, not yours, but any others?
Yes. But I don't think we lost but two or three. Rarely could you go to Berlin without losing some, because they had a lot of flak.
So you knew when you got in that plane, that could be your last flight.
Oh, you could, but you didn't think like that.
Okay, I'm just wondering.
I guess sometimes you would say, when you're in tough circumstances, say, look, God, just let me get through this thing, just this time.
I understand.
I'm sure there were a lot of prayers
going out at that time.
Mm-hmm.
Wow. You know, some of these stories, I know that, and sometimes you don't even think about these stories very much, do you? And then you talk
right.
about them and things come up, and I'm sure, like, I'm sitting there going, oh, my God, how did you make it through it? Sometimes I bet you got to say to yourself, oh, my God, how did I make it through this?
Yep. Yep.
Well, after you got out now on kind of unusual circumstances, didn't you?
Yeah, they had a point system. Excuse me, after the war in Germany ended, and the war in Japan, of course, was still going on. So they had a point system to let people out because they knew they didn't need that many people. And I went to navigation school after I came back, thought that might be a good idea, or some dumb reason I decided to be a navigator. But I was in San Marcos, Texas at navigation school, and it turned out I had more points than anybody on that base, because the other pilots there were the guys that were flying us navigation students around. And they gave you points for time overseas, for how many medals and decorations you had, and a lot of other stuff. So since I had the most points on that base, I went into the base commander and said, I want to get out on points. And he said, well, you're not eligible. You're a navigation student. And he called the sergeant over and he says, this guy thinks he can get out because he's got enough points to qualify in the pilot's allotment. And the staff sergeant says, yeah, he does. And so I got out, and that was it. Got out in June, I think, of 45. That's right, I think, yeah.
Okay. And so then what'd you do?
Then I started engineering school in Chicago at Illinois Tech, and partway through it, I transferred to Purdue, roomed with my old Army buddy.
And in between time, though, you were working on planes, weren't you?
Yeah, well, while I was waiting for school to start in Chicago, I worked as a mechanic on the flight line for Douglas DC-4s, four-engine transport planes.
They were built on where O'Hare was.
They were the plant was at what is now O'Hare. Yeah.
So and you were working how many jobs now? You were working more than one job here.
Well, not at that okay. not at that time. Not
okay.
After I started school, I worked after school. I stopped on the way home at a sheet metal factory and would put in several hours on Tuesday and Thursday. And then on Friday, would fly in the reserve out of what is now O'Hare Airport, and on Friday afternoon, and then Friday night, Saturday, and Sunday, I worked in a liquor store.
You weren't too busy, were you, Lloyd?
Nope.
Nope.
Well, I didn't have time to get in trouble, I guess.
Yes, that's true. That's true. So, and even while doing that, you got your engineering degree in less time than most people do, yes?
2 years and 10 months, yeah.
And there's an interesting story when you were almost ready to graduate, isn't there, about being pulled in to say, we're not going to graduate you or something? Where the head of the school or whatever said we don't take transfer students.
This was the guy, the head of the mechanical engineering department at Purdue. Just before I was ready to graduate, he called me into the office and he said, "I don't understand how you're here." He says, "You transferred from Illinois Tech," and he says, "We don't accept transfer students." Well, fortunately, he was on vacation when I went down there to visit my old Army roommate, and I decided it'd be a good idea to switch schools. So I went up to the assistant head of the department. He says, "Okay, everything looks fine." So I got in and finished.
And that was pretty phenomenal, 2 years and 10 months.
Yeah, but yep. I took a lot of hours.
A lot of hours.
I took over 20 hours many semesters.
And plus, you were out there working and everything. You know, Lloyd, one of the things that I wanted to mention is that you were awarded the Distinguished Flying Cross. That's a pretty awesome award.
Mm-hmm.
Yes, and you certainly have gone on. Now, what did you do? What's the short story once you got your degree and everything? What happened?
Well, I went to work for Phillips Petroleum Company in Oklahoma City. Was transferred out to West Texas, got married when in Oklahoma. We had a daughter. West Texas was a terrible place to live. My wife couldn't stand it. Carbon black plants were proficient out there, and this was the old technology. You short of time?
All we're going to do is say this is WCRS right here in Greenwood. Go ahead.
Carbon black at that time, you know, carbon black is what makes tires black.
Right.
And they had a channel black plants all over. I think there were 9 plants surrounded in border Texas in the Texas Panhandle. And they produced this carbon black by burning natural gas with, they'd starve it of oxygen, so it created a lot of smoke. And that smoke was the carbon black. And they had panels that were hanging on a chain. These panels, they were metal panels about 20 feet long by 3 feet wide. And they would go on a rotating chain and go over these burners. And then the carbon would plate on the burners, and then they'd scrape it off the end of the line.
Wow. You know,
the only trouble with that was that they were not very efficient, so they'd have an exhaust stack at the end of the line, and all that carbon that didn't plate on the these
panels.
Metal things would go out the stack and blow over the town. So everything had carbon black on it. But Phillips developed an electrostatic precipitator to put on a what was called furnace black, and that cut down the amount of emissions dramatically, made the place a lot better to live. Now, I left there before they had but one unit. They still had all of the channel black plants when we left.
Now, that was the Korean War was just getting in.
That's when the Korean War,
And they wanted you to come back in.
I got orders to report for B-29 transition in Texas.
And how did you get out of that now, Lloyd?
But I had moved from that time to Baton Rouge, Louisiana, working for Ethel. And I didn't get the orders. And I finally got a telegram, I don't know, probably 2 or 3 weeks after I was supposed to report. And I sent a telegram back saying I had moved and all of that stuff, and what do I do next? And they said, "Well, go to Montgomery, Alabama, and we'll see where we send you from there." I did that and met a colonel who, I guess you'd say, he was the review board. And he says, "I gather you don't want to go back and fly B-29s. I said, "That's right, I do not." I said, "After all, I'm married, I've got a daughter, and I've got an engineering degree, and I can do a lot better for my country as an engineer than I can flying a darn bomber. I've got too many friends who would be tickled to death to be called back in and fly again, but not me. And the company had a guy who would petition for you to get a deferment, mm-hmm. and that guy did a good job along with this review board, and he got me a 3-month deferment, and it was extended to 6, and by that time the Korean War was winding down, so I was permanently taken off from the active duty.
Well, Lloyd Andrews, thank you for your service to our country, and thank you for sharing your stories this afternoon. As a veteran, we appreciate so much what you did for our country, and so nice of you to come by, and so nice of you as a across-the-street neighbor that I never get to see to actually sit down and talk for a while. Thank you.
You're very welcome.
All right.
Thank you. I've enjoyed it.
All right. Thank you so much. This is WCRS right here in Greenwood. We'll be posting the podcast if you didn't get to hear it, or if you know somebody that would like to hear it. We'll be posting the podcast on our website and also the video on YouTube. That's going to do it for us. Bye-bye, everybody. Hey, by the way, tomorrow morning, 9:45, we're going to be talking to Congressman Mick Mulvaney right here on the I Love Ann Show. Bye-bye, everybody.